can we open up to the floor for questions arising from these topics? So, yeah, open to the audience.
Professor Johns, you have a very alluring aside at the beginning of your talk about robots in the bedroom. I noticed that when you were talking about qualities that were necessary for gender and ethnic sexuality, it's not listed. Could you make some comments about that?
Well, I'd rather not, because I've looked into it, although there's another great movie called Westworld, where this topic is explored in some detail, which I strongly recommend. It's got Yul Brynner in it.
Yes, I can see it.
Yeah. Involved in this. I don't think he's one that lands in the bedroom, but my colleague Blaine Whitley has made the point that most sort of technologies, the internet being an obvious example, are one of the most ready users and widespread users of new technologies is the sex industry. And maybe the person who knows about it all. I think there is already enormous interest in robotic sex toys and sex companions. I know that wasn't something that you're doing at yet, at any rate.
Ryan Wilkes at the University of Oxford. On that note, I don't know if you know, but Michael David Levy, a colleague of mine, has just published a book on sex and love with robots. I'm going to recommend it. It was a Dutch PhD thesis, but it's quite fun to read. Can I ask a more serious question? I run a European project called Companions, and we don't do the robots, and I can't find out all this stuff, but it seems to be the robots in some sense dispensable. I mean, the idea of something brings you a cup of tea in the morning is deeply embedded in the British psyche. Who needs that? And so what we need is some kind of, if we want anything along these lines, I think, is some kind of companion with persistent personality, someone we can talk to, will know about us, know us for many years maybe. So I wonder why the robotics, if we went the other route, which is the guy like, it would certainly do away with Steve Torrance's worry about robots crashing up the world like old cars. And indeed, there are other advantages. I mean, I want a companion that will appear on a mobile phone, appear on a laptop, possibly be incarnated on my kitchen table, but maybe not. As long as it's the same companion in all cases. I'm just thinking, why are you so obsessed with physical embodiment?
Well,
do you
advise
jump in, but the scenario you just described when we start studying the first of March onwards as part of Beekeeping Project on Lyric. The scenario you just described, having these differently embodied companions on your PDA, on your laptop, physically embodied robot, that's a new European project that will start on the 1st of March. It's called Lyric.
I'm part
of it, so it is exactly that scenario.
It's also a big European project called Companions.
Yeah, exactly. Which is based on that, yes.
Any other comments from other members of the panel on that topic?
I just wanted to say that of course, when we think of robots, we think of robots in many, many different ways. It's convenient to think of humanoid robots, but of course, there's no reason why they should be human. Or human size, and maybe a mobile phone is going to be the way that proliferation may occur is something like our cell phone or our sat nav may become in some richer sense, or at least an agent in a much richer sense. The kind that we're thinking of. It's great to see you all.
Thanks. Go on to University of Essex. I'd just like to make a comment about embodiment. If you look at the title of this meeting, it's Robots and Rights. Will artificial intelligence change the meaning of human rights? Now, if an algorithm in the building society's computer denies me a mortgage, I don't think it's anything to do with my human rights. On the other hand, if a physical robot denies me entry to a building by standing in front of me or by a constraining me. I do think that's an infringement of my human rights. I think what we've got to recognise is the sphere of action. I know that certainly philosophy and ethics, the discussion of all these various fine examples of the runaway railway carriage, which is going to either kill 5 people or 1 people, you've got access to the points, you can switch it between the 1 and the 5. If you switch it from 5 to the 1, all you're guilty of murder to 1. And the parallel thing whereby if there are no points but there's a very fat man next to you, if you throw him onto the tracks, you can stop anybody being killed. And people find the switching from 5 to 1 morally acceptable. They don't find pushing the fat person off the bridge to save 5 lives morally acceptable. And I think the physical embodiment is absolutely crucial. I think that's one of the things that good old-fashioned AI completely missed out on, the importance of embodiment. And if anything to do with recent developments in AI, it's the dawning realisation that embodiment is not only relevant to intelligence, it's absolutely crucial.
I'm not sure I see why you decided to go irrelevant whether the system was embodied or not. So a mortgage application, okay. Suppose it was something more serious for you, right? Whether you should be put in prison or the duration of your prison sentence. You might met an AI system being given the power to decide such a that might be a greater infringement of your rights if it executed its work poorly than if you're blocked from entering a building or whatever. And I think that ethical issues could arise from whether or not that sort of judge AI had a physical body or whether it was just from a chicken side of a PC.
I mean, clearly there are many humans that have very limited bodily activity that are still capable of living lives that have enormous ethical significance. So embodiment is an important aspect of what makes us human. Therefore, I think it's absolutely right that your sort of work involves embodiment in a deep way that it does, but it maybe doesn't. They can also be reduced embodiment, which still is ethically important.
I was trying to get back to the relevance of the robots in the title of this, because it seemed that some of us have just been talking about artificial intelligence in general, and not about robots. And I think there is a key difference between a software computer-based AI system and robots. There certainly is ethical. I think there may well be.
Well, there's a huge philosophical tradition, religious tradition, call it what you like, that personalities don't have to be embodied. We all know that one. We're still in that tradition in some sense. I mean, this embodiment, I mean, I take all your points about embodiment, isn't the simple fact. What's changed everything is the internet. See, I mean, a web agent is not embodied. But a web agent now, I mean, can do, I suspect web agents will begin to have personality. And for other people, they can book their tickets for them, book train tickets, so, you know, read them the news. I mean, I think you have to be a bit broader about it.
I think this also depends on how we define the embodiment. I don't want to go too deep into this discussion, but for example, if you think about an embodied conversational agent, a graphical representation, an interactive representation of a whether human like, or robot like, or you know, animal like, and this character portrays personality, shows gestures, talks, has facial expressions, can also recognize from the human these gestures, facial expressions, and so on, then for me, this agent or this character will still be embodied in its environment in some sense, because it is able to respond to the environment, to act on the environment, to make decisions based on consequences in this environment. So I think we need to see a spectrum from pure software, you know, this kind of executable that you click on and it does something, and you know, and the physical robot, there are these embodied conversational agents, or however you might call them, or synthetic characters, that have many, many, or that share many, many aspects with the physically embodied robot, although they are virtual. Where I would agree is that the physicality of a robot adds something on top, which, for example, touch. Think about touch. I talk a lot about human-human interaction, the handshake or the French, you know, the kiss on the cheek or whatever you like. So with respect to embodiment, I just want to make the point that there's not only no embodiment, or there is full embodiment, there are also transitions between it. And some of these AI things, like embodied conversational agents, are somewhere in between. So it people relate to them in some way as they would relate to a physical thing. Maybe not exactly, because they can easily make them disappear or just switching off the monitor, for example. But there are some issues there that are also interesting to look at, also from basically all of these things that were mentioned here, the moral status. It would be very interesting to apply exactly the same thing to these virtual embodied conversational agents. They can be long-term too. They can have their autobiography and long-term memory. They can have a relationship with you too. So, it might be interesting to broaden the discussion also to include these kind of agents that are not physically embodied, but they are embodied in the sense of being situated in the environment and respond to it.
Would you call them robots?
I would not call them robots.
Can I just make a thanks. I mean, you can think of a virtual agent, a web-based agent, as disembodied, but you could also say, well, all virtuality has to have physicality. All software has to have hardware, and whatever that hardware is, in this case, it's going to be, and some arbitrary network of computers probably changing across the United States or wherever, plus the screen and keyboard in front of you. That's its embodiment. This doesn't have to be the embodiment of a computer agent.
Still on the road.
Could we have a question towards the back?
Putting two things together, the embodiment one and the thought of the autonomous vehicles, for instance, which
drive a car for you. And have control. You drive your car exactly the same software with a lot of the same knowledge. It's going to be driving hundreds, thousands, millions of cars at the same time. And it makes an error. You didn't make it, the software made it. What do you do to all the multiple embodiments? Do you pull more off the road if they make a bad error? And it's got to be able to take decisions like, I'm going to kill one person to avoid killing five.
It's going to be brave on that one.
I have something that I'd like to say about this, because I feel quite strongly about this, because a few months ago, a sat nav that my friend was driving on the way back from Cambridge, just round the corner from my home, she said, oh, this is where I turn. I turn right here. I said, no, don't do that. You're going to a train line. And it had actually identified the road. It hadn't noticed that there was a train line in between this end of the road and the part that I lived in. There are lots of errors on these systems anyway. But it seems to me that in these cases, you just have to say it's the manufacturer's responsibility, or the you can't. It seems to me this is very clear. I can't see there being a problem, as kind of dilemma there about blaming or you may have to withdraw the or produce an update pretty quickly as a software.
It seems no different than any other product. Like there's a bad piece of Cadbury that causes stomach illness, and then do you withdraw all the Cadbury's in the market, or do you just the batch that was sent to that store? It seems that there's nothing particular about the fact that it's an AI system or a robotic system in this model problem, if it's just a helping product.
Yes,
maybe
it's yourself.
Thank you. I was just wondering, when you're talking about consciousness and sentience later on, I was wondering, do you consider emotion to be an important part of sentience or consciousness? Because, I mean, if you do take science fiction examples, Data from Star Trek The Next Generation, he's considered sentient, yet he doesn't have emotions. I mean, how important would you say emotions are in our definitions of consciousness?
That's for
anyone.
It's interesting, you can be conscious without having emotions. I mean, you can be conscious of, say, colors without feeling either sad or angry or upset, or as humans might be in certain conditions, we're not full of emotions all the time. Obviously, in human psychology, emotions are big. But one shouldn't assume that all other possible cognitive architectures would use emotions as sort of an organizing entity. It might just be certain kinds of minds that use that, but maybe that would be other ways of organizing behavior in artificial intelligence. That's kind of not the question.
Thanks. It's Commander Data, isn't it, who's the one who doesn't have emotions?
Yeah.
Or actually doesn't have consciousness. I'm not sure if Commander Data actually has sentience either.
They argue there is an issue where he's put on trial and they argue his consciousness.
I have trouble wondering how a creature like Data could have evolved. Because it seems the conditions for evolution on his planet were so similar to Earth that he has sort of outward human form. So he's in many respects outwardly, sort of well within the uncanny valley, or maybe beyond, but has no emotions and maybe no consciousness. But I think both those things would be a sort of integral part of a sort of evolutionary trajectory that led to his having the intelligence and physical functionality that he has. So, yeah, I see emotion and consciousness very closely intertwined, because I see them both as very strongly biological features of us.
Thank you.
I'm waiting to speak from the Netherlands and Wolfsburg. I can offer myself this. the perspective in all your talks has been very much on moral challenges these systems will pose us when they are coming, and they will come properly. That's your presupposition. But when you you can also shift perspective and ask what direction do we want to steer this development, so that we still are moral agents. I like to, I don't know to whom I'm asking this, maybe you can all give one example, a direction in which we definitely should steer these developments. So what kind of artificial intelligence is really desirable?
As I try to convey, there are many, many more areas where I think robots can be useful, and where AI can make a contribution. The way that concerns me is just to raise some of these issues of design issues. Let me give you an example. Very often when I talk to representatives of companies who build these very flashy, fantastic robots that you see on the news or the market, on BBC News online every few months there's a new article, a new robot has been out. If you actually talk to the designers of the robots, then what happens very often is that they approach me and my team and others, of course. So they approach the researchers asking them, can you think of applications can you please tell us scenarios where we could actually use these robots? So what is happening is that very often you have this technology-centered view where people build a fantastic robot because it is possible. And yeah, some of them look, you know, yeah, they look quite nice. And some of them can do nice things, but then you have these robots and nobody actually knows what to do with them. And which means it could be a waste of, well, I wouldn't call it a waste of effort and money, but I mean, kidding, you know, they have often, you know, millions of pounds or whatever currency you use have been put into that. Rather than what other projects also do, more research projects, where you first identify your application area and your target users, and then you do a clear assessment of the requirements and the needs and the scenarios, and then you try to design your robot according to these requirements and so on. It doesn't mean that robot will be better than the other ones or it will be more successful, but chances are much better that the way it will behave is much more tailored to its actual use that was in that people looked at in the first place. So something
that's also meant to talk that for human centered design.
Yes. So if you talk to people in HCI, I don't know what your background is, but for them this is old news because that's what they have learned. They have learned you cannot first build your interface from a purely technical point of view, say computer science point of view, then show it to people and ask them, do you like it? Well, that doesn't really, really work, but what you have to do, you know, is to involve the target audience from day one when you design services. And this is, in other communities, this is, as I said, almost old news. They have had, you know, years and years, decades of learning in this process, but in robotics, it's still very much a more technology-centered viewpoint. You know, when you have this robot, you let them do something, but often the designers don't really know what they should do with it, and they invite researchers, can you please take my robot and do something useful with it? Mm-hmm. So then we can then say, oh, this robot is doing something better. So that's more the way how we are trying to make a tiny little bit of contribution to, as I said, sort of trying to general learning experience in the group.
How about you?
Just give an example. You really like.
Well, I think there should be more effort on the friendly AI problem because it's so much more important than all the other things, even if it's further out. And there's about one person in the world currently working on this environmental.
Who is he?
Yudkowsky, Elias Yudkowsky. And that might be what, you know, there is a chance that that is what will determine the future of matter in life of the universe. But no, maybe that will turn out to be the critical thing 4 years from now, or 8 years from now. Whether we have cracked the problem of friendliness before we get, you know, figure out how to do super intelligence. I mean, as for current AI systems, I mean, I see them mainly as a set of tools. The industrial robots, well, you know, if they increase productivity in industry, they build more of them and otherwise spend the money on other things. With military robots, there is some specific. And that's one of the primary funders of robotics research right now in the US military, who is really keen on taking the soldiers out of the war as much as possible, moving them away from the front line and using. On aerial vehicles, ground vehicles for reconnaissance and for complete missions. I think that's going to, you know, just increase over the coming decade or two according to all projections, as it's a factory in the modern warfare situation. And there, I think, it would make sense as a broader effort of thinking through how to conduct wars or how to prevent wars in ethical ways, to think of what is the role of these robotic machines in fighting wars.
And finally, Steve Torrance, your response to that.
Okay, thank you. Well, as this is the Royal Society for Medicine, I should say, which I think anyway, that possibly one of the most promising areas is in medicine. Maybe, I don't just mean robot doctors or nurses, I think it's as simple-minded as that, but the development of I'm sure it's just an outgrowth of what is the kind of technologies that are already in the clinical field, but which are more, you know, have more functional autonomy and can be considered as robotic. Of course, it depends on what you mean by robots. I mean, in a way, we all have robots in our homes because we have printers, for example, that physically, you know, do things for us, deliver us bits of paper, stuff printed on them. If you think of that as a robot, then there are lots of robots already around anyway.
Thank you. Once again, to all our speakers, I'm going to hand over some closing comments to Magic.